things to talk about on religious liberty. And I don't know about you, but I always found them interesting when I was younger. Did I mention, I'm not normally this, I'm not discombobulated, but I'm unsure what I said this morning. Did I mention the Salamanca vision this morning? I don't think I did. And I have a burden to share that. When I was a young fella, I was a teenager when I came to Washington, and around the General Conference, I used to hear all the different leaders, but of any of them, I enjoyed hearing Roland Hegstead talking about religious liberty, and usually in the context of the communist era, and it was captivating, because there were real problems at that time. But one thing that he spoke of, apart from current events, that just really clicked with me, over and over again, I heard him tell the story of Ellen White and the Salamanca vision. And it resonates with me now because I've had some of the same problems with Liberty Magazine. But A.T. Jones was, as I said this morning, was in a war at times with different leaders of the church, often over petty things, not doctrinal things. And Ellen White usually supported him. But it got worse and worse, and it came to a point where there was open attacks on the magazine that he edited, the precursor to Liberty Magazine. And at that point, when she was in upstate New York at a camp meeting in Salamanca, New York, Ellen White had an impressive vision that stirred her so much she made comments to several people about it, but she didn't tell them the full details. And she didn't even really know what it was all about. I mean, she knew what was shown to her, but she didn't understand the context for the simple reason that it hadn't yet happened. But a year later, the church leaders had a secret meeting late at night, I think it was about 2 o'clock at night, where most of the leaders got together to discuss our religious liberty work and the Liberty Sentinel. And there were a faction that were against the magazine. In fact, in the meeting, they said that it was objectionable to them that the Sentinel of Liberty was so direct in Adventist viewpoints, so direct in the Sabbath and prophetic understandings, and that it should be, these things should be removed. And Ellen White had been shown this a year earlier. So when she told her vision, she repeated exactly what they said in secret. And she says they got up and they said, in fact, that they said that they if the magazine didn't change, they were going to terminate it and begin another magazine. And Ellen White said that they said, as they said, they should take the Sabbath out of it, they should take Adventist understandings out of it, and it would be very successful with influential men. And she said their faces brightened as they thought how wonderfully successful it could be. And she said this was but the beginning of a series of bad steps in compromise. Well, to some degree, that was headed off when she gave that testimony. But I can tell you that same thing continues today. There are a number of Adventists who would be quite happy for Liberty Magazine to just go to the political leaders and talk about nice constitutional issues and freedom in general, religion in general, but they get embarrassed when it talks about Adventist particulars. They get embarrassed when it talks about prophetic understandings. And even within our system at times, I've had to help fight them off. Even on the same-sex marriage, for example, gay rights. You have no idea within our system the opposition to us dealing with this topic. And it even came to the point where at a public meeting in Canada, I don't want to name the person, even though it's not secret, but a lawyer associated with the General Conference, since retired, he got up and he said that the Adventist Church had been slow to understand women's rights, which was true. He said it had been slow to understand civil rights, which was true. And he said, the day is coming when practicing gays and their lovers will be in church membership and holding church office. And the sooner we do this, the better. Which is a fallacy and a direct opposition to the Bible. But that's how bold some of these people have been. And so I believe that Liberty Magazine, as in Ellen White's time with A.T. Jones, so today it has an obligation to present a very particular Adventist construct of religious freedom and of the events surrounding these last day prophetic developments. And these are the last days. But I'll just start off by telling one more story. I never thought I'd be editing Liberty Magazine. Even just to get into editing, it was sort of by chance, because I grew up with my father at the General Conference, with the division for a while, and then the General Conference, and people used to pat me on the head, and they'd say, "You're going to be a pastor, just like your father." And I was not against my father, but I didn't want to be under that shadow forever, so, you know, I think not going to. But when I finished university and offered myself to the church, I found that I ended up in editing and almost unwillingly got into some of the same battles. And the thing that stuck in my mind was just engraved there, was some experiences that took place when I was not yet 20. And my father took us on a world trip to some of the places that he'd been contacting. And we went to Bulgaria, hardcore communist regime at the time under the Soviet system. It's where they used to have the Warsaw Pact military exercises because they were very secure in Bulgaria. And he'd gone there as guest of the government many times, and so he took our family in. And he said later it was a foolish thing, because it was actually quite dangerous, even at that time. Bulgaria was radical communist. Remember, they sent people down assassinating people in free Europe and so on. They were quite aggressive. But we were able to go, and on the Sabbath we went to an Adventist church, and they were under severe restrictions. But they were allowed to meet at a certain time. I think it was like 2 or 3 hours on Sabbath morning. They had permission, and then go out and suffer the consequences out in the community. And my father spoke to them. He was not allowed to speak to them. He was only allowed to bring greetings. That was the official allowance. So I remember he brought greetings for about an hour. But after, in the side room, we got into conversation with the man that translated for him. I remember his name. It was George. And he knew English, obviously. And George had a sad sort of a face. He appeared very old to me, but in retrospect, he probably wasn't more than 40s. But he looked very old. And he had this sad face, but very pleasant young lady with him, probably 14 or so. And he introduced her. He said, "This is my daughter." And he said, "Will you pray for her?" He said, "She's a good girl." He said, "She comes to church every Sabbath." But he said, "Because of that, because she's not in school where she's required to be," he said, "the government are going to take her away from us." And as a young fellow, that really affected me. I could identify with that young girl. I mean, not her, quite her age, but I mean, you know, here's another young person. And she was dedicated to the church, and because of that, nothing else but because of that, she was going to be taken away. And I remember Dad explaining it to us, and we talked about it at lunch here. That was the standard thing in communist countries, that if in educating your children, you encourage them to follow the church, to come to church instead of to school, you would lose them. And typically, most Adventists would send their children to school, because they did not want a conflict with the state. Then they became embarrassed at people like George that persisted in opposing the state. And so very often they would act against them, disfellowship them. There were horrible fights within the church. And what we heard here in the West was often that that they had doctrinal problems within the church. But that's what they were typically over. It was all about whether the people were going to be faithful to God or compromise with the state. And it affected me big time. And so when Liberty Magazine presented itself, when Clifford Goldstein moved on, you know, he said to me, "Why don't you apply?" Well, it seemed very appropriate, but I never for a moment, until that moment when he'd already moved to the Sabbath School Quarterlies, thought that this might be something I'd work with. But I believe in it. I believe in it. And I'm very convinced that religious liberty is central to what we should be understanding in our day about how to present the gospel and how to relate to governments, to peoples around us. This is where the front line is. It's not just something that the church does. We're living in an interesting period of history. The United States has a good record of religious liberty. Who am I to malign it? And please don't think that I'm trying to downplay the US's role. I came from Australia, but I think everybody in the Western world knows that the United States, as the large civil experiment that followed on not just from the Reformation, but from the Enlightenment period in Europe, civil understandings of the rights of man, basically humanistic viewpoint, but coming together with Protestant viewpoints. The United States was a great experiment, and that the Constitution is an embodiment of their aspiration is very good on religious liberty. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law establishing religion, nor prevent the free exercise thereof. So taken at face value, the Constitution says government's out of the legal business of religion, and it should not restrict your practice of religion in any way. The only other religion clause in the Constitution, which most people don't even seem to be aware of, obviously after the last presidential election, is it says no religious test for public office. That's it as far as the Constitution. They're very good terms, but general and hard to apply. And that's one of the reasons why, if you read Liberty Magazine, pay any attention to religious liberty, we have so much ongoing problem in the workplace. Because it sounds great that the government's out of the religion business, but there are societal attitudes and local laws of one degree or another that can restrict you. And very often, Adventists and others who claim an exemption in the workplace because of their faith, they find that it doesn't come easy. I even heard some discussion this morning about Walmart. You know, companies like Walmart, they set up, even in their application, wording to ferret out whether or not you want some religious accommodation. You won't get a job if they get any inkling that you have religious exemption intentions. So in practice, it's not that easy always here. There's a general acceptance of the religious liberty concept, but the practice here is not necessarily much better than any other Western country. Obviously, much better than Saudi Arabia, where unless you're a Muslim, or if you're wanting to change from being a Muslim to anything else, you'll lose your head. No, we're not in that realm. But it's not as free as it might appear. And in fact, even the little accommodation that you will get in the workplace is primarily because of the civil rights legislation, not the Constitution itself. Because Title VII of the Constitution says that you cannot be or should not be discriminated against on the basis of race, gender, disability, or religion. And that is held reasonably well until recently. But anyone that's following history knows that we're in an unprecedented, but that's wrong. But we're in a historic shift toward unbounded capitalist concepts. And evidence of that, I'll cite the Supreme Court decision not too long ago that corporations are individuals. You know, that reminds me of Orwell's Animal Farm. You know, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal. I mean, it's gibberish unless you understand the rise of big business interests. Their influence is incredible, where individuals who are now restricted, still restricted on campaign contributions, but corporations through cover organizations can give unlimited amounts. So, the balance is swinging in this country. And with that rise of that viewpoint, we're finding that accommodation in the workplace is harder than ever. For about 6 years, or maybe closer to 7 years now, the church has been working with a coalition of about 30 other religious and civil rights groups to get through a piece of legislation called the Workplace Religious Freedom Act, and we haven't got it through, and I would say our chances now are almost nil. A couple of years ago, we thought we had it. And the aim of this was to reverse the dynamic that's occurring in the workplace. And the simplest way to describe it is, while accommodation might be allowed, the courts have been holding the employer to a standard where, as long as they expend, in a legal term, a de minimis amount to accommodate you, they're off the hook. And de minimis can mean $1 worth of value to accommodate. Or to put it in a practical term, if you're in a workplace and you ask for Friday night sunset through to sunset Saturday night for your Sabbath, and they give you 1 week off, the next week they can say, this is too much. We have expended this difficulty. We can't do it every week. And that's the end of it. And the court would typically count that as a reasonable application to help your right for religious freedom. We had backers for this. It was John Kerry. There was Dick Sent, not Dick. Why can't I think of his first name? Senator Santorum. Anyhow, Santorum on the Conservatives. There was Kerry, John Kerry. There was Hillary Clinton. Anyhow, all of the big hitters, Conservative and Liberal, were both behind it. And we had two hearings in Congress, which typically, or congressional committees, that's typically means you're on the fast track. But the second hearing was very troubling. The employers came and spoke against it, but that was to be expected. But after their representatives, then the gay lobby got up and they said that if religious people were granted this stronger exemption in the workplace, that it would be used against gays, and therefore they were opposing it. And as you probably know from listening to the news anymore, that's the flavor of the month on minority rights, and to suggest that it might restrict that end of it. So it's not the end of religious liberty, but it's a reminder to me, and that's the way I'm tilting it to you, that things are not as clear in this country as it might appear. And as very many things in this country, as well as most countries for that matter, justice has a little relationship to socioeconomic status. If you're a professional, the chances are you can work around it fine. I remember in one of our meetings, a woman got up and she said that she had lost a practice that she had, a 500,000, even that sounds small, but I think it was a 500, she lost 500,000 a year because of her practice, and she was forced to go and seek employment elsewhere. And I noticed that there was no sympathy in the meeting to her case because, as she said, she just moved and got another job of a similar level. But somebody that's in a blue-collar position, little education, not too many options on employment, they might find that there's a lot at stake and they don't get accommodation easily. And if they don't get it, their whole livelihood suffers. This is the unfortunate reality of Sunday and Saturday issues, religious accommodation. What I wanted to say before we have questions, and I don't know if your expectation is to have questions, what I wanted to say is we need to think for a moment, a few moments, maybe discuss later, is freedom generally, and in particular religious liberty, at any threat in the West? And is it at any threat, particularly in the United States? You know, I'm a history major, or used to be a history major, and I love studying history. And there's some developments in Western understandings of freedom that have changed negatively in the last several decades, and the US has been no exception. Some of those things have been percolating along underneath, and were revealed in stark relief after 9/11. 9/11 didn't so much change things as reveal things. And certainly since 9/11, the way liberties are understood is quite startling. I remember as I was traveling around talking to people, especially immediately after 9/11, I had several elderly couples come up to me, and they still do on occasion. But these couples that year, they identified themselves as Germans. And they said that they were living in Germany just before World War II, and they were full of foreboding because what they were observing here had uncanny parallels to what they experienced in German society in the build-up to the Nazi takeover. And, you know, I'm not for a moment suggesting that either the Bush or now the Obama administration are Nazis or anything like that, but shifts in how we see the rights of the individual, rights to privacy, rights to personal security, those are quantum shifts, and they have direct bearing on how you will be regarded as a person with a minority religious affiliation. This is a little different country than Europe, where even though everyone says how Europe is a secular society, which it is, but its religious identifications are very plain. And if you're in one country, you'll be a Lutheran. If you're in another country, your identification is uniformly, say, Catholic or whatever. Those things mean that within that religious majority, you know, you're treated like everyone else. But the U.S. is different. This is a thoroughly fragmented religious community that at different times in the past have been often violent toward each other, but since none of them have a majority view, they've reached a truce understanding. And that's the only way to really understand how the federal constitution came about. Every single one of the 13 original states was very vigorous in persecuting religious minorities. But when they covenanted together, they didn't want the other guy to tell them what to do. So it was all off the table. And for that matter, before the Civil War, they felt free to act that way in their individual state. But with the incorporation of the federal constitution after the Civil War, now uniformly we adopt that view. But I do believe as we enter a more and more stressful time, minority religious views are really going to receive short thrift in society and perhaps even in the courts at the same time that we accept this general principle of religious freedom. Ella White says, in particular speaking about the Sunday law, that eventually the United States will repudiate, is the word she uses, every single principle of the Constitution. And when I was a kid in the Adventist Church, we used to live in fear and trembling of constitutional conventions, thinking that that's how the U.S. would repudiate it. You and I know since 9/11, we will not likely ever repudiate these things. They'll sit nicely under glass, you know, in the Capitol or any other place they have these documents on display, even as we go our own way doing something quite different. About 3 weeks ago, I was in Florida, at a fairly large church near, was in Orlando, but it was just down the road from the Forest Lake Church, but it was another church. I won't say where it was, but I found that they were just buzzed about predators. And I can get people fired up when I want to, but I was a bit mystified. Why were they all so bothered about predators? When I shook hands, that's all people wanted to talk about. I actually had to leave before an afternoon meeting, which they held anyway, but I stayed for the dinner and I heard them promoting it. It was all about predators. So I asked somebody, I said, why are you so bothered about the predators? And they said, oh, we had an article in the newspaper this last week. The sheriff said that he's wanting to get predator drones armed with missiles for law enforcement in this county. Amazing. That's where we are today. But you know, it's less than 1 year ago that Liberty Magazine had an article on electioneering and improper use of religion, and the author was Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. I'd seen an article that he'd written in the Washington Post, and I asked him if he could rewrite it for Liberty. So because of that, I was watching for this guy, and one day I turned on my TV in my office, and here he's on C-SPAN. He was discussing the Defense Authorization Act, just a dry thing that normally people don't worry much about, except few sharp eyes had noticed that Senator McCain and another senator had added two paragraphs to it, or actually only two sentences, which enlarged the military operation against terrorism to include the U.S., and it said particularly that they could operate against U.S. citizens. And of course, a big debate went up in Washington. What did they mean by that? Because people said, well, the Constitution says otherwise. But at the end of the day, the thing stood. And Jonathan Turley was on C-SPAN discussing that. Now, he's a law professor at George Washington University, a well-published guy, held in high regard. And so his opinion you have to pay some attention to. It's not that you couldn't find a lawyer with another view, but he is an informed person. And I could not believe when he was interviewed for nearly an hour, he said that not only was that bad, he says, I expect to see within short order drones used against Americans here in the U.S. with deadly force. I thought, what sort of a radical viewpoint is that? Where does he get that from? And I watched, and within, I'd say, a month, I noticed that the FAA lodged flight paths across the U.S. because you can't have airliners hitting these things. And then I read two or three articles. I remember one was in Atlantic Magazine, another was in, I think, New Republic, discussing how all across the U.S., various law enforcement agencies are lining up to get these things, to put cameras, rocket launchers, grenade launchers, and all the rest on them. This is the brave new world. You know, it's not religious liberty per se, it's civil liberty. And as Hillary Clinton said once, talking to our religious liberty group, we have an annual dinner and we had her one year, she said correctly, you cannot separate religious liberty from all the other civil liberties. If one gets restricted, you can guarantee there'll be restriction on the others. And she also said correctly that religious liberty is the preeminent civil liberty. But to restrict civil liberties on one area and to think that religious liberty won't be affected is naive, especially since this all derives from the War on Terror, which is a thinly disguised rivalry and war between a radical religious faction from the Islamic world and what they see as the Christian world. It's religious conflict, and it's sharpened religious identities. There, a lot of what you read in the newspaper or see on the media from these different sites claiming that Christians are being restricted here and that and the other, they're nearly always from some radical Christian rights group that are rolling what it is to be an American together with being a Christian. And I believe we are seeing here what has already happened in Europe, that in response to an external radical religious threat, we are in the process of defining the religious identity of the United States. It's never going to be one religion, but one religious viewpoint that is wrapped around the flag. And once that is in place, and you're outside that flagpole, or not outside that tent, it might go very badly for you in a time of stress. I don't know, I better quit while I'm ahead, but you know, again, we live in a wonderful country, but it's a country in transition. It's a country in transition. And I'll end before we have questions, because that's really what you want to know, answers to what you say. Years ago, I went to a meeting in Colorado Springs that was an eye-opener to me. I was the guest of an Adventist lawyer who was a board member of this right-wing planning group. And they met for 3 days. First day, we had dinner Focus on the Family, Dobson, James Dobson. And I sat next to him, so we had an interesting conversation. So that showed me the religious affiliation with this right-wing political group. There were 3 Reagan cabinet members in the board, and I'd say there was about 20 board members, and 2 billionaires. They were right-wing movers and shakers. But the second day, we had a breakfast, and I don't know how I was allowed to be there as an invitee, because I was the only outside person. But there were about 4 tables in a small room, and we ate breakfast, and we listened to just one event, a lecture by a U.S. general in charge of the Northern Command. And I hadn't even known to that point that the world is divided up into quadrants. And the Northern Command is the homeland with reference pointing out to Canada and Mexico, and it's everything, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, National Guard, the lot. And he was a very nice person. I saw nothing ominous about his demeanor. He was in uniform, representing the military, not just talking about them as someone that was working in the military. And he got up and in great detail described military plans for moving against terrorism in the US. And I'm thinking, this is interesting. In fact, I was dumbfounded because I first thought posse comitatus laws. It's not the Constitution, but there's a long-standing law that the military is not supposed to move against the citizens. And what I was hearing was tanks down the main street. And he must have seen me, because I whispered to the guy with me. I said, what are they going to do with the detainees? Doesn't matter what country you're in, military don't give detainees to the police. They don't think the police are competent, but they also never have any evidence. So they just won't do it. And I must have looked scandalized. So this guy stopped, General Eberhardt stopped after a couple of minutes, and he said, some people may have problems with what we're planning on doing because of posse comitatus laws. He says, we don't see a problem because of changes to the law. And to this day, I don't know what those changes are. I don't believe that they are of bad intention towards citizens at all. This is a country with generally high aspirations, but it's a country that has forgotten its founding principles. We're in a society. I've got a 14, now in 2 weeks, a 15-year-old at home, and I know these kids don't know the Constitution. The legislators don't know the Constitution. They read it aloud the other day, and it was the most disgusting thing. If I was the high school teacher, I'd fail all of them. They repeated things, they missed things, they stumbled over it. Our Western society, and the U.S. is a very good representative, has forgotten the lessons of history. And under the panic of a perceived outside threat, with politicians, as always, who would love to take advantage of it, we're in a rush toward totalitarianism. And that's fine. You and I as Christians can just describe it. But we should be aware that as that happens, differences that have always existed on religious affiliation, claims that you make for accommodation that have been difficult at best on an old system will become highly threatening to those that think differently from us. And that's really what's coming down the pike. You can differ from me all you like. I mean, you could be right, I could be wrong, but I think I've got good descriptive arguments that something is happening. And so the question is, how do Adventists relate to this? Do we, you know, presume that it's okay? Or do we sort of steel ourselves to, as I said this morning, to serve God regardless? I don't believe, fervently believe, I mean, hold this view, I don't believe that any Christian anywhere is called to challenge the government's viewpoint. You think, you know, sure, you believe that here in the United States, but even if you were living in Iraq before the invasion under Saddam, or even if you were living in the Soviet Union, similarly, I don't believe it's the role of a Christian to bring down or attack or challenge whatever the system we're living under. The only time we should be implacable in our opposition is when it asks us to do something counter to what God does. And my fear is, and there's a few cryptic statements of Ellen White, that in the United States, more than any country, we are not ready to do that because we have always been told, implicitly if not explicitly, that this is somehow God's country, that, you know, that it's to be an American is to be tied up with God's will for not just our country, but for the whole world. And even Adventists have participated in that, but it's a misreading of what our pioneers said. There's a difference between God guiding this country as it did certain correct things, and as people of religious sentiment fled from the old world and established a new world. That's not the same as saying that whatever happens here is God's will. And God will only bless any country or any peoples when they do what he wants. But, you know, nationalism has it the other way around. As George Bush said once in one of his hard-to-untangle comments, but I remember it clearly, he said, God has blessed America, and he couldn't have blessed more deserving people. Well, we're not deserving of God's blessing unless we do the right things. We're not deserving of God's blessing just because we're Americans. And since 9/11, I think the fix is in. I remember listening to the hearings for the Patriot Act, and the head, I think he was the head of the what was the committee that approved it, the not Ways and Means. Anyhow, I know I'm tired now, my mind is going, and I'm sorry. Anyhow, the senator, Democratic senator that was in charge of it, he asked Senator Ashcroft, he says, you know, why should we give you this bill? He said, it's nothing but a grab bag of things that the right wing have wanted for decades. Well, they got it. Very quick, and those of you that wonder about Sunday laws, and I can tell you there's nothing on the horizon for Sunday laws, nothing. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be here next month, because think of the Patriot Act. September 10, you think there was any Patriot Act sitting in any committee? Nothing. And it was passed within a couple of days after September 11. And it was Senator Leahy that was head of the Judiciary Committee. And after it was approved, he came out on the steps of the Capitol, and I saw him on television. And he said, and gave a press conference, and he says, it's called the Patriot Act. He says, I voted against it. Where does that leave me? Now, if a public official can have that sort of sense of threat from opposing these emergency measures, I can tell you, we need to be very sober about how we relate to these ongoing events. And we are in a war that has a religious tinge. There's no two ways about it. It's a burden of mine, and I'll only talk 5 more minutes. It's a burden of mine that Adventists are woefully ignorant about Islam. And it ranges from, I guess, just outright prejudice, but by and large, Adventists want to work with Islam, and we believe, because we keep being told this, that it's just a slight doctrinal misunderstanding. I've talked to a lot of imams. My father had great contacts with the Islamic world, and over the years, I've spent hours talking to the imams. I've read the Quran, which puts me ahead of nearly anyone, unfortunately, because people don't read it. And the Quran is quite a scary document. But apart from anything else, if you know this one thing, you would be relatively clear on, from a Christian Adventist point of view, where Islam is. It says in Surah 5, which is like chapter 5, in a long extended riff on the topic, it says this: they do blaspheme. This is in the English translation, but this, I've memorized it. They do blaspheme who say that Jesus is the Son of God. God has no son. Now, what does Paul say about the Antichrist? Who is the Antichrist but he that denies that Jesus, that God has come in the flesh? That is a direct challenge to God. And that statement, by the way, is actually inscribed in the Dome of the Rock, the third most holy place in Islam, that's over an old Christian church in Jerusalem. They've inscribed in the dome, God has no son. And God must have people of open minds in Islam as well as in any other religion that can come to him. That's not the question. Of course there's good human beings, but as a belief system, it is set against God's word. And it's worth remembering as Seventh-day Adventists that Uriah Smith in Daniel and the Revelation has an entire chapter on Islam, and his interpretation there was held by all of his contemporaries in the church, including Ellen White. She was most specific that interpretation was correct, and they held that Islam fulfilled the fifth trumpet, I think it is, of Revelation 9, where it talks about Islam coming out of the bottom, it doesn't say Islam, but the group that comes out of the bottomless pit, and their leader is Apollyon. And it, as far as historic reality, that they connected it not to our time, they didn't know that, but it was connected in its fulfillment to the attack of Islam to Europe in the time of Martin Luther. Turkish Islamic forces overran most of Europe. They threatened Vienna. They went up into France. There were major battles there to fight them back. It was touch and go whether Christian Europe would survive. And curiously enough, God worked through that dynamic to allow the Reformation. And curiously enough, Islam, when it was moving up into Europe, the instructions to the Muslim soldiers were very plain. It said, do not harm anybody that believes in the book. In other words, that is truly following the Bible. But kill without mercy anybody that wears the tonsure. That was the priests. And I know there's somebody going around the Adventist community with lectures on Islam, many lectures, but with lectures on Islam and Masonry, for example, and claiming that both Masons and Muslims are manufactured organizations from the Roman Catholic Church. That's nonsense. And I just gave you one evidence. Islam is an implacable enemy of Roman Catholicism, or has been through the ages. We're looking at major forces that are now clashing. You know, I remember years ago going and listening to Samuel Huntington, this academic. He's dead now, but he brought up this idea of clash of civilizations. Well, he was a bit one-dimensional in his explanation, but on one level he's pretty much correct that with certain catalysts like the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan and our recruiting radical Islam and then the offenses against their way of life in countries around the world, Islam is on fire and determined to attack the Christian West, not because, as George Bush said, they envy what we have, but because they see us as the great Satan. And yet, if you and I as Christians look at Islam, you'll see there that this is the great deception. What did Ellen White say about the Roman Catholic Church? She says that it appeals to almost the entire world, two classes, those that would be saved in their sins and those that would be saved by working their way to salvation. And Islam is pretty much the same. It's a works-oriented, loveless religion. It says all the time Allah is most merciful, but he's not demonstrated as a God of mercy. It's a God who says that anyone that departs from the faith is to be eviscerated and killed without mercy. Dangerous times. Anyhow, I've gone on a riff that I usually don't go quite that far on it, but I want you to see that there's trouble in paradise here and that the whole world is really in a large-scale religious conflict, which of course is aided and empowered by all sorts of other things like natural calamities, by economic collapse, and even the breakdown of the old order. Because we've got to face the fact that even though Revelation 13 is plain, that the United States plays a leading role at the very end of time, as a matter of history, the U.S. has peaked. This is a empire in decline, and ironically, that's when things really get rough usually. An empire secure in its power where it can do anything it wants is not greatly to be feared, even though it will impose its force. It's when it gets frantic, frustrated, as we're seeing now, and economically and militarily. Everything is up for grabs, particularly religious freedom. Does anyone have any questions? I don't know if there's a microphone for questions. We need the microphone.
Catholicism is like a little horn, and you said Islam, and you just made the comment there, and some other commentator that puts them together, the symbolism that they both use are very similar, and if they're the same system, like the little horn power behind the Catholic Church, and if it's the rise of the beast from Islam, isn't the same thing then? It's just same.
Well, they're not the same thing, but there's certain similar dynamics. They both own your body, soul, and spirit, and they're both embracing certain erroneous viewpoints, but they're not the same. I'll be very surprised if they were ever to make a common alliance. and structurally, Islam is not easily capable of it. It took the U.S. several years in Iraq to sort of grasp the fact that Islam is many factions. You know, in Iraq, we finally were able to pit the Sunnis against the Shiites. The whole Islamic world is divided between the many factions, but these are the two main factions. Islam persecutes the Ahmadiyya Muslims relentlessly. There are 8 million Ahmadiyyas, and every now and again in Pakistan particularly, if you follow the news, there'll be a couple of hundred people butchered in cold blood. Ahmadiyya Muslims. And the curious thing, these are the Muslims you are most likely to hear from, other than, well, you're not in the area, but on the East Coast you can contact black Muslims, it's another variant. But the Ahmadiyya Muslims, it's a sect that began roughly at the time of the rise of the Seventh Adventist Church in the mid 1880s. Yes, not the rise, but I mean when we were consolidating. And it was brought into being by a man that was troubled that Islam might be vulnerable to the mention of Jesus. And so if you talk to the Ahmadiyyas, they're all for Jesus. But and not until you get well into it do you realize that they've hijacked their view of Jesus. And like all Muslims, they believe that Jesus didn't die on the cross, escaped the cross, lived out his life, died of old age, married and had children and so on. The Ahmadiyya Muslims is just a more sophisticated way to slide you into a Unitarian view where they don't believe in the Trinity, but they believe in the figure of Jesus, not as the God, not as a God's son, but a representative from God that can lead you then through Muhammad to a fuller understanding of Allah. No, the Baha'i are a sort of a synthesis of Islam and Zoroastrian and other viewpoints, and even it's not really from Christianity, but it appears to involve some Christian stuff. But it's a more universalist form of worship, and the Baha'is are persecuted again implacably by the Iranians, the Persians. I remember in, 6 years ago now, we had a world conference in South Africa, and Mohammed Abati came. He was the advisor to the then president of Iran. He was one of the clerics. And I'll never forget him getting up. He was addressing the group of about 500, and someone asked him about the Baha'is, whether the Iranian government could do anything to help them. The person didn't understand that they're the ones persecuting them. But his reply was incredible. He said they deserve what they got because they backed the wrong party. But no, the Baha'is have been persecuted consistently within Islam. So there's no centralized control in Islam. Within a given country, there might be, like in Iran, the holy city of Qom, where they have schools of theology. You could get a major cleric to back you, and you could probably influence most of that country. And certainly in Saudi Arabia, the Mufti there in Riyadh, he could influence that whole country. But there's no Pope, there's no World Council of Churches for Islam. It's really a very fragmented system, and all you have to do in Islam is you read the Quran, you become convicted of what you're reading, you get a few people around you, followers, and then you call yourself an imam and you build a mosque, and that's it. It's like Southern Baptist writ large. There's not a way to confirm that they really even know the Quran. And I can tell you one of the most shocking things that I saw on that same trip my father took us to Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But in Pakistan, I'll never forget going to a little room, no bigger than the stage area, no windows that I can remember. It was almost pitch black except the light coming in the door. And there was a man up front with the Quran, reading it out one line at a time, and row after row of little 8 to 12-year-old boys sitting cross-legged on the floor, and they would chant back the line after him all day. And you know, we sometimes joke that even in the Adventist church or in any Christian church, if people read the Bible, you know, rote without any sense, just sort of, it'll jumble their mind. You know, we get these letters from people that are handwritten, just scribbled everywhere, And I wonder about the mental process, but I can guarantee that you get an uneducated, undernourished kid and 8 or so hours a day in a dark room reciting back this cryptic stuff from the Quran, it'll send them almost around the bend. And I'll just tell you one other thing that's in the Quran. I was on YouTube the other day trying to find information about Syria, and I saw a video. It wasn't real clear where it was. I think it was in Egypt. But I think that because the religious leader up front had a topi rather than a turban. But he was talking to a crowd of a couple of 100,000, and he whipped out his sword, and it was a scimitar, you know, with the curved blade, the jagged peak on it. And he whipped it out and swung it around over his head as the crowd was yelling and screaming, and he yelled out, he says, "The day will come when the rocks will cry out, 'Come here, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him.'" Well, that's from the Quran. That's a direct quote from the Quran. You think that stuff won't affect people's brains? It's crazy. That's the expectation at the end of time, the day of vengeance, when every Muslim is to kill Jews. Not good for a little 10, 12-year-old to be just absorbing this without any context, that no greater education in life. And, you know, and that's what's going wrong in Pakistan. They don't have much public education, but the madrasas or religious schools are proliferating, and this is what they give them. Anyhow, don't want to go on and on.
You stated that America is on a fast track race towards totalitarianism. Can you give us a good example of that, like Exhibit A?
Sorry?
You said America was on a fast track towards totalitarianism.
Well, I could tell you more, but I better quit because I really don't want to appear anti-American. I'm not anti-American. I love this country. But it's gone quieter now, but you know, arbitrary detentions. The Patriot Act, for example, allows the government to, and they do it all the time, check on what books you take out of the library. They check on what you look at on the internet. Believe me, people have had some severe troubles with the law on that alone. And on one level you understand it, but it doesn't make the legal shift any more comforting. With terrorism, we've got a problem where Islamic terrorism, you know, they often kill themselves. So you can't wait till the crime's committed to get after them. They're dealing with potential. So if someone has the profile or an advanced activity that would imply that they'll do that, then everything comes down on them. I don't want to get into all of the legal shifts. There's been no or little formal change to the major laws since 9/11, but things have been done that are against the law and not been challenged. I'll tell you one thing. To me, this should answer everything else. The Constitution is very plain on enumerated powers for the president. And, you know, we have, the president, I've got to be careful of this. Liberty, as our religious liberty work, we need to be careful we're not partisan in our political comments. Ellen White said that any pastor or teacher that's involved in partisan political activity should resign or be fired. We cannot afford to be for one party or the other. But it's obvious when we deal with this topic, we're talking about politics the whole time. The politicians themselves don't seem to understand this. I listen to all these hearings, and over again I'll hear a politician saying, "I'm not being political on this." They can't help but be political. What they mean is, "I'm not being partisan," and that may or may not be possible for them. We need to be careful on that. But the powers of the president were clearly laid out in the Constitution, not to mention the expectation of the revolutionaries who formed this government. You know, they were bothered by King George and Parliament overstepping their bounds. They then put George Washington in his office, and he had some personal problems, like he was criticized for holding his levies. Anyone heard of that? On a raised platform, every now and then, he and his wife would receive the citizenry, and he could sort of answer their questions. That was harking back to the time of the kings, on a, you know, the levy, the raised thing. But by and large, George Washington fulfilled the expectation, and he would not take the crown, it was offered to him, and he left office voluntarily, went back to his farm. But in recent years, there's this presidential imperial presidency that's coming to pass, and I can probably say nothing better in this regard than to tell you what I heard when I drove down to Florida one day. I listened to the whole confirmation hearing of Attorney Gonzalez, Attorney General Gonzalez, and then I read all the papers I could and listened to the media, and they did not report on what was said, and it was earth-shaking. They asked him, and I think it was Joe Biden, asked him at one point, he says, do you believe, is it true that you believe that the president is not bound by the laws of Congress? Now, apart from the question, these politicians are great at giving their answer to someone else's question. You know, they never answer it. They'll dodge it like crazy. So I was quite surprised when he said, that is true. And so then Biden, I think it was Biden, but anyhow, the senator questioning him got outraged, and he says, you mean the laws passed by the people's representatives and signed into law by him, by the president or his predecessors, not bound by those laws? No, sir. That is the view that has taken root. And to me, it shouldn't be explained very much. If that is the view, then at least in theory, we have as despotic a structure as ever existed in the old world. And it's being put forward now that the president slash his advisors and so on, they can have hit lists and all the rest. I mean, do you realize what we're living through? It's acceptable only because you and I don't feel threatened by it. But if you've got to look at law with along the line of precedent and structure. If something is being put in place and not challenged, it will hold legally when it is challenged. And what can be done in one case then can be done in another. You know, I don't really think at the moment that they've got anyone particularly has bad intentions for any group within the country. But we've allowed a structural shift to take place that will enable the very worst things that prophecy predicts. That's my view in a nutshell.
Islam.
And at the same time, it's a good country. But just, and again, and I'm not trying to diminish the U.S. It's probably as good as a place to live in the world. But you've got to remember that someone quoted this morning, you know, that that Jesus said until the flood came, you know, they were giving in marriage and so on up till the moment, and we're told that right till the second coming of Christ, there'll be an air of normalcy. And in most countries, even some of the most dysfunctional from our point of view, there's a normal life that takes place. And my wife's from Guatemala, Central America, and I was married a few decades ago when they had civil war there. I remember going to that country, and she told me, say nothing about politics, and you'll be fine. But people that meddled in politics, you find them by the side of the road with a bullet in the head, whether they were a priest or who were meddlers at that time, a priest or a local activist or whatever. But for the average person, it didn't matter. It was one government, one leader. It might as well be the same as the other. Society worked as it always had. And so don't be misled just because there's no Black Hawk cruising over your neighborhood. We're turning into a security state. The Washington Post ran two stories, or more than stories, two whole issues almost, within the last 12 months on the security apparatus that sprung up, a hidden apparatus. There are 1 million people in the US that work for organizations set up since 9/11 that are not open to public review. And I can remember as a kid reading about East Germany and places like that where they had the Stasi, and you know, there were three or four layers of security people. But I go to Washington and I see there's the Secret Service, there's the Homeland Security Police, there's the FBI, and they're all floating around with uniforms. It's layered security that is just unreal. And I'm only telling you this by way of description. There's nothing we can do about it, but it should be, you know, the Bible says over and over again, when you see these things, do this, because it's a sign to you of what's happening. Even at the airport, I fly all the time. it just troubles me mightily. And I came up through the Vietnam era, and it was a horrible thing that happened in the U.S. where draftees that were sent to Vietnam, when they came back, the public basically spat on them. I know that. But here in this era, we've developed a love affair with the whole prestige of the military, and it won't turn out well. And at the airport, you know, we stand at attention, and we're told to applaud often, and we stand there as the military load on first, and often we have to stay in our seats till they get off first. And I said to someone once, I said, we might as well be in Berlin in 1936. It's got to be the same. When there's a privileged military class, it's not healthy for a democratic open society. And we've absorbed all of this thinking that it's fine. It's even, you know, their guilt from Vietnam. We feel like, well, we better encourage them. But they are mercenaries today. These are not citizen soldiers. These are citizens who have chosen to go into a mercenary operation. And even worse, in Iraq. Now, I'm sorry, you're getting my personal opinion now, but in Iraq, I listened to the hearings. And did you know, you wouldn't know this because you'd never heard it in the newspaper, but I listened to the hearings. At the very end of the surge, if you read the newspapers, there was supposed to be about 130,000 soldiers in Iraq. I listened to it, and I heard the Inspector General outline it, and it was a hearing on contractors. So they gave the figure incidentally, but there were 200,000 soldiers in Iraq, and there were 200,000 contractors paid typically $1,000 a day, and they hired everybody from the ex-Soviet goons to the sealer scouts from South Africa that the old South African regime used to send around to wipe out entire villages. Soldiers of fortune from all around the world have been hired to do incredible, unspeakable things in Iraq and some in Afghanistan. And this hearing that I mentioned, I think I mentioned this morning that we heard listened to the hearing on the Workplace Religious Freedom Act. Before we got up, there was a congressman there with a young woman, and I knew about the case, so it was interesting to me, a young woman who had been employed by Blackwater in Iraq. And when she'd arrived in Iraq, she'd been gang raped by a whole bunch of Blackwater employees, and the supervisor came around and found out what had happened, and he just told her to suck it up and keep quiet. And then they continued to work her over. So she escaped. And then when she got back to the US, she went to a congressman, and he was there with her. And I heard them say what I read, that by the edict of Ambassador Bremer, who was the proconsul over Iraq, he exempted contractors from Iraqi law. As independent contractors, they're exempt from American military justice, and as overseas workers, they're exempt from US justice. They are outlaws. No law has ever been invoked against the contractors in Iraq, and there's plenty of cases of them killing people for the fun of it. You can even go on YouTube, it's still there, I think, pictures they themselves take driving down Baghdad, firing indiscriminately out the windows, and you can see people being killed. There's no accountability. And you know, these are not wrongs that we're all responsible for, per se, but they're all symptoms of a drift towards something unspeakable. And it's happening before our eyes. Wasn't it President Dwight Eisenhower that warned against the military-industrial complex? Massive, and it's out of control. The sequester has been held over the heads of the U.S. Public for what is it, $200 billion? Have you ever thought of what we spend on the military? It's more than all the rest of the world combined. It's roughly equal to what it would cost for a national healthcare service in the U.S. which we don't have, but every other Western country has. You know, these are just, it's a great country, but but it shifted in ways that are ominous. And religion is center of it. It always has been in the U.S. This is a country that believes in the separation of church and state, that is an admirable principle that liberty will defend to the very end of time. The reason that it's so important in the U.S. is there is so much church. Religious sentiments are rife here. And don't believe that it's true, that the simple answer that you get, that we've never had the religious wars that Europe has had. I gave a bit of a reason why it's not in the classic sense, because we're not monolithic religious populations here. But, you know, the governor of Illinois had an extermination warrant out on the Mormons at one stage. Did you know that? Did you know that in the U.S. history, for a whole weekend, a crowd of several tens of thousands of people roamed through New York, lynching every Catholic they could lay their hands on? There's been horrible things. There's religious sensibilities just waiting to be given the carte blanche to indulge their prejudices. And, you know, that's always been the case. But I think the structure now is moving us toward where something will happen. Another question?
Is this on?
Oh, sorry. Change the subject slightly from what you've been talking about.
Yeah, we need to get on another area.
Obviously, the last week or two, three, 4 weeks actually,
the Pope
and the Pope resigning, and now a Jesuit Pope and one from the Americas. Do you have any
comments? I don't know how many. You're obviously not reading Liberty, or I'd have been held down by now, because I was bold enough to predict who the Pope would be. And I did that knowing that in my lifetime there have been several popes come and gone, and never have the prognosticators got it right. Never. They're not even close. But I thought that it might have been Cardinal Dolan of New York. So I didn't hinge my whole thing on it, but I threw it out just to see that it could have been Cardinal Dolan. And I said that if he was elected, he'd probably call himself Peter. And I was interested that toward the very end, the bookkeepers the bookies in England were putting very good odds that he would be called Peter. Well, they were wrong too. But I know why they were doing it and why I did it. Because there's certain expectations in the Catholic Church based on apocalyptic prophecies of St. Malachy. Anyone heard of that? An Irish priest in the year around 1100, he... in a cryptic way outlined a description of every pope to the end, and according to his list, although there's some debate whether he really meant to be the end of the list or just the last named person, but the last pope is this current one, and he says that the last one would be called Peter. All that I'm still certain of, I mean, I was wrong on the name, but I'm confirmed now on the view that I put in the article that Benedict, while he had many practical reasons to want out of that job. We know that the sex scandal seemed to be eating him alive. He was known to be a bad administrator. His health clearly was bad. I'm trying to think of some of the other reasons, but they were enough. And the cues that he was throwing were very plain. He twice visited the tomb of Celestine V, the first pope to resign. And the Pope that since he resigned, he was only Pope for like 6 months, and Celestine, when he accepted the job, he quickly passed, it's not legislation, passed a canon law allowance where he could resign, and then he resigned. But twice Benedict visited the tomb of Celestine, said publicly that he admired him, that it was a great thing, and the second time he visited, he left his papal robes there as a souvenir to hang in the museum. So I think he's been flirting with this for a long time. But to me, it resonates on a political level that I understand from Australia and observing England, but not from US government. The Westminster system, when a politician is elected, it's like be a four or five year term. But they don't wait for the 4 or 5 years. That would be foolish. They wait until, whether it's good popular support or some great development, they'll call a snap election at the time of their choosing, so that they can guarantee either their election or their continuation of their policies. And this is what Benedict has accomplished. We know, it's undeniable, in fact it's acknowledged, that Benedict and John Paul II, very close personal friends, and under the John Paul Pontificate, Benedict was the prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, the Holy Inquisition, and he wrote all of the important documents. And so when his friend died, remember, he was head of the cardinals in the conclave, and he did a Dick Cheney and put himself up as the Pope. He did that to continue conservative policies of John Paul. So if he was wanting to do it then, and he's been consistent in his views, he clearly needed to continue that. He'd appointed, I think it was 80 of the cardinals are his appointees, so he'd stacked the deck. And by springing it on them, he hadn't allowed time for factions to consolidate on other candidates. Whether this guy's his choice, I don't know. But a Jesuit is hardly a liberal. It's never happened before. Remember, the Jesuit order was established to be, literally, the soldiers to defend the Pope. And you know, while they may not much want to refer back to it, you know, Adventists know, I think it's in great controversy, their oath, you know, to stab, murder, and extirpate, and all the rest, Protestants, wherever they find them. You know, they're not at root, you know, a mild group. And it's already troubling to find out that this cardinal from Argentina, and by the way, it was a clever device to get a non-Roman and yet still a European, because Argentina, I was there this last year, it's an incredibly European country, and Buenos Aires, you might as well be in Europe, Western Europe. It reminds me of Barcelona in Spain, and they're mostly Italians and some Germans. So they've, in essence, got a European there. But it's very worrying already. It's come out that in the period, a couple of decades ago, when the military junta were tackling the leftists, and tens of thousands of young people disappeared, that during that period, this present pope allied himself with the junta and actually signaled to them that dissident priests didn't matter what happened to them. And there's a priest in Argentina that's already saying that he was delivered to the kind officers of the junta because of this cardinal's statement that, you know, they weren't protecting him anymore. So the connection I would make, it's not the end of the answer, but at least a connection of meaning to what we're talking about. John Paul II was a very charismatic leader. And that's also why I thought that Dolan might get it. But John Paul II was charismatic, but he was not liberal. He was as hardcore conservative as they come. And there was a pivotal time, fairly early in his presidency, when he went in his papacy, when he went down to Nicaragua and met with the military junta that had taken over, the communist, not military, the communist junta, socialist junta. And I remember seeing the video when he came off the plane. The first guy to meet him was one member of the junta, a Jesuit priest. And then there was another second priest, a Mary Noel priest, who's now in charge of the General Assembly, believe it or not, of the UN. And as the first priest came, he kneeled down and reached for the Pope's ring. And the Pope pulled his hand away and then just screamed at him. And on that same visit, and you can find it on YouTube, there's an amazing scene of the Pope talking to a group of young people in Nicaragua, and they laughed at him, they booed him, and he totally loses it. He was screaming and yelling at them and going like this and all the rest, and he stomps off, and he went back to Rome, and he said, from now on, he said, we will, because they had liberation theology to that point, and that's why those priests were with the communist faction there. But he says, from now on, we will be with power. And he disbanded all of the priests that were working for liberation theology, and at the same time, he threatened the Jesuit order with dissolution because they were not loyal. He removed the leader of the order. I'm trying to think of the something general of the order, and he made every Jesuit swear personal fealty to the Pope, not just to the Church. So there's something big going on in Rome. It's a swing toward conservatism. And if you read my editorial, at the moment, Rome is saying very good things on religious liberty. We work with them. Our church has good relations with the Roman Catholic Church, because they believe in religious liberty. They're being persecuted in many countries. So on that level, we work with them. The reason that they are true believers on religious liberty is Vatican II. In the 60s, they had a rethink on a lot of things, and because of a document called Dignitatis Humanae, or the dignity of man, they've become true believers in the rights of the individual. But John Paul and now Benedict, even though Benedict was part of Vatican II, have turned against it, and they're trying to roll it back. And when they move back to pre-Vatican II days, watch out. Because Cardinal Dolan, and I heard him just a few months ago, I was at a meeting where he was speaking, and nice guy, but as he was holding forth against the Obama administration and saying, because their view was that their religious freedom is being restricted, and he was saying, we believe it for all people. And then he paused, and he said, there was a time, he said, before Vatican II, when Roman Catholics held that error has no rights. But he said, because of Vatican II, we understand. Well, therefore, Vatican II is under attack within the Catholic Church. So if it falls, then we're back to error has no rights.
Question here.
Yeah. Oh, over there. Yeah.
Islam worships on Friday, and we, of course, keep the Sabbath as God's people. 2.2 million Christians, billion Christians, worship on Sunday. How is Islam going to join in with Christianity in following the mark of the beast?
I don't know how I got in this position today. You're a very loyal church group here, and I've said things that are on the fringe. Not on the fringe, but you know, that you might differ from. But you've got me on something. This is my view. I've read Great Controversy a lot lately, and it's very interesting to me that Ellen White nearly always, when she talks about the Sunday law, refers to it as going out throughout Christendom. And in my view, whether or not the Sunday law applies to the whole world, we'll see. But as far as the test, it can only be a test to Christians. What test is it now? You know, a Buddhist country has been dealing with all the religions, other religions, Islam, Christianity, for centuries, to suddenly demand that they worship on Sunday is a meaningless test. And I really, in myself, think that it's at least reasonable that at the end of time there'll be certain groups, while nobody, no individual is beyond salvation, you know, that's plain until God says, you know, he that is filthy, let him be filthy still. But as far as groups, I think, just as there were in Canaan when God's people went in, there were certain groups that their false beliefs and practices had so blocked it in for them that there was no test for them. I think it's the same at the end of time. It's the Christian world that can be held to account as to whether they'll worship on the biblical day or the non-biblical day. That's the best I can say on that. As far as Islam, I don't really... Thank you, I could drink, but I'm not really... I sat down one afternoon in my office at the when I was at the Review and Herald and talked to the head imam from the Washington Mosque, and we had a good talk. And he was the one that first one to tell me that the Quran mentions the Sabbath, but it does it in a funny way. It says that God's punishment rests on the Jews because they profane God's Sabbath. So I said to him, and I've read it since, obviously, but I said to him, well, how come Islam doesn't keep the Saturday Sabbath? And he gave me the most self-serving, drawn-out, funny sort of an explanation that basically is summarized by the fact that the animus in Saudi Arabia that Muhammad was dealing with already worshipped on Friday, and then he didn't want to trouble them. So it's true that the Quran knows the day, but it's rejected along with Judaism. The Quran, I mean, the Quran's got a lot of interesting stuff. Well, not interesting, it's like the Book of Mormon. They're both pretty low on the literary scale, I think. But it, you know, there's some interlude stuff in it. But from beginning to end, it will keep coming back to two themes, an attack on Jews, an attack on Christians. I mean, that's just... And I don't know of another holy book like that.
question.
Yes. Oh, see the yellow.
You talked a little bit about the Muslim influence developing in the United States.
Is that with the mic?
Yes, hello.
Oh, let's look at the yellow one.
Development of the Muslim influence in the United States, do you see that concurring with the increased interest in the Sharia law within the United States, and how does that impact religious freedom as well as women's rights and that sort of thing?
I try not to brag because it gets you in a lot of trouble. And usually on afternoon meetings, I tell people I don't know all the answers, but I know most of the questions because of these meetings. Mark Twain? Well, many people. Mark Twain was one of the ones that says predictions are always very difficult, but particularly about the future. You know, who knows where it'll go. But I have a theory on this. And I usually say it in regard to the gay movement. I really don't think that the gay rights thing is going to win the day. Obviously, we live in a time of gross immorality. You know, that's plain. But I think, here's a parallel, as Germany, between the wars, that was riven with social meltdown, homosexuality, transvestitism, and debauchery of all times were pretty common in Germany, especially in the cities between the wars, and it offended the burghers out in the country, and they wanted to morally clean up their country. And obviously when Hitler came along, that was his appeal, moral renewal, and the churches were with him. You've got to read the history to know it. He didn't force himself on the country. And I believe in this country, this gay movement, while a lot of good people feel that, yes, you know, the logic of it is sort of intimidating. They might not personally much care for gay rights or gays or whatever, you know, gay behavior. But they don't feel empowered to resist it. And people say what they think they're expected to say. Oh, yeah, they're now in favor of it. But I don't think out in Des Moines and places like that they care for this whatsoever. I think it's offensive. And I think at some point it's going to reach a peak and there'll be a lashback. Probably after that it'll be don't ask, don't tell, because I don't think the behavior's going away. The Catholic Church has shown that it can be protected and institutionalized. But I think this open rights, I think I just don't see that it being sustained. And the same with Sharia law. That's not Western law. That's not anything close to a critical mass view in the U.S., It's offensive, and I think what the gay movement and moves towards Sharia law will do will be to encourage and deepen the fallback to some sort of Christian America concept. Yeah, and it's a good way for me to mention a group that over the years I've mentioned a lot, but you don't hear much about them, but they're influential. Within the right-wing Christian community, there's a group called Christian Reconstructionists. A fellow named Rush Dooney developed it late 60s, early 70s. His son, Gary North, has carried it on. And under the Bush administration, I was always reading his name mentioned in White House confabs. So they had the ear of politicians and the religious right. A movement that you do know about, Dominionism, is Christian Reconstructionism light. That's where it came from. And that's pretty endemic among the right-wing religionists in this country. And the Christian Reconstructionists want to establish an Old Testament regime in the United States. It's sort of Christian Sharia, administer the laws of the Old Testament. And they have said plainly that when they get power, which I don't think they will ever in their own right, but when they get power, after a six-month cooling-off period, that there would be mandatory death for adultery, for homosexuality, and for Sabbath breaking, and they mean Sunday. And only a few months ago, I was quite interested that one of the representatives of, of, of the group, Christian Reconstructionists, went public, and he said that they have thought about it, and they probably wouldn't now apply mandatory death to homosexuality. They would be quite willing to have a don't ask, don't tell policy. And something that, if you've read Liberty, you'd know, we've had a huge problem in the last 2 years to cover the term. I would say about a year ago, but within the last 2 years, some of these Reconstructionist-influenced politicians and religious leaders in the U.S. have taken seminars here and then moved them over to Africa, and a couple of legislators have acted on it in Africa, and I think it was in Rwanda, one country, and another neighboring country. They actually passed death penalty decrees against gays, incorrigible gay behavior. And that's because of the Christian Reconstructionists in the U.S. And they've been most embarrassed by it because these Africans have stated very publicly that this is what they were taught. This is the underlying view of the right-wing religionists here. They're just not saying it publicly. So there's a lot at play. Interesting times, I believe.
It says the makeup of the Protestants in the U.S. will go to the Catholics to join together. The same wording of it. Apostate Protestantism will make.
I remember the quote. I have a good memory, but I don't like memorizing. But Ellen White writes, she says, when the leading churches of the United States, uniting upon such points of doctrine as are held by them in common, shall move upon the government to sustain their institutions and enforce their decrees, in other words, state aid and Sunday law, she says, then Protestant America will have formed an image to the Roman hierarchy, civil penalties against dissenters will inevitably follow. That's just one quote, but there's nothing in what Ellen White writes that suggests that Protestant America will ever be incorporated into Rome. Okay. In fact, I think we've arrived at the point that's required, where, as Senator Santorum said in the Republican primaries, and people got worked up about it, he said, Protestantism is absent in America. It's not to be seen. Well, so the Protestant character of this country is not plain anymore. President Bush, for example, when he went to Andrews Air Force Base, which he never did to meet any head of state, they used to meet him at the White House, but he went to Andrews, met the Pope, and said he looked in his face and he saw God, which is his right. I mean, it's nothing unconstitutional for the president to say that, but very telling. A Protestant country is enamored with the papacy, working with them on many fronts. So, I the world is wandering after the beast, and the Protestant world is not thinking Protestantism anymore.
Well, they do that.
I think it's the stage is set for us in sympathy with Rome to start enforcing laws as they did, religious laws.
Well, they do that to combat Islam.
I do believe that Islam is acting as a catalyst. I don't believe, like a fellow that I know very well from Idaho, is traveling around trying to say he's trying to say Islam is the king of the South, and the Christian world, aided by the papacy or instigated the papacy, are going to wipe out Islam, and then the survivors will unite with Christianity. I think that's all fanciful stuff. Well, you should study it. It's a free world, but I know the person. I've talked to him, and I have opinions. But I took all the material to the Biblical Research Institute, and they've been in contact, and they're quite plain that it's unsustained. Theology doesn't make sense on it, and you've got to be careful of this, because remember, most of us have lived through the communist era, and there were people inclined to read communism into last day prophecies, where now it's sort of abundantly obvious. That didn't majorly figure in things, was a catalyst, and a lot of things that happened in the U.S. were done in reaction to godless communism. Even the current debates we're having on church-state issues on Ten Commandment postings and monuments in chambers or in public buildings and grounds all over the U.S. That was done, something clearly against the Constitution, but it was done in the U.S. at a time when we wanted to position ourselves as a Christian nation as opposed to godless communism. Where in better times it wouldn't have happened. So we're dealing with the blowback from it still.
Okay.
Someone asked the question about how would Islam ever give up Friday and start worshiping on Sunday. My understanding is that in the Quran there's information about Mary, and they believe in Marian. And so I'm wondering if there were Marian appearances that would come to their imams and say, you need to be worshiping on Sunday. We've had this all wrong. That could be an easily done thing with them because, you know, they're kind of superstitious anyway.
Well, they could. Well, you know, some of them are superstitious. It depends what country. It's, you know, it's like saying that Baptists in the Appalachians are superstitious or Christians in the Appalachians are superstitious. That's because they're simple people there, not because Christianity is like, I've got to defend Islam to some degree. Yeah, it's true. The Quran is very deferential to Mary. She's not elevated to any degree, but one of their attacks on Jews is that they insulted Mary's son Jesus and also his mother. It's certain. We know that Satan will appear as an angel of the light, deceiving spirit, and you know, he'll say this and that and the other, and that Sunday is now the day. If that happened, that's true. But still, think about it. What would that accomplish if a lying spirit deceived Islamists who are following a false doctrine to start with to follow another false doctrine? What is it? I mean, to some degree, Satan doesn't need to further trouble those that are already in his grasp, does he? It's worth thinking about. What we see some evidence of, and it's always anecdotal, but I've talked to people that I think it's fairly close to the actual thing. I'm hearing that on a number of occasions, people in Islamic communities have seen angels in dreams, particularly that suggest that they need to go at a certain place and talk to these people and find out about Jesus and Sabbath and so on. So yes, this is the part that we don't know. We just know that God can do it, take things into his own hands, and we don't know how God will communicate. We hope to a great degree, but it's plain from the Bible that he's chosen to use us as his emissaries, and there's some things that if we don't do them, they won't get done. But I can tell you, I guess, automatically get my views, and I'm sorry. But you know, I'm a child of the church. I've grown up around it. I've been to camp meetings and GCs my whole life. And it never sat well with me that at our general conference session especially, we have the list of world countries and we're checking them off where we've entered. And I can tell you there's plenty of countries we say we're in and we might have one church or two churches. Nobody knows about us. That hasn't fulfilled the gospel commission. In my view, the gospel commission was largely fulfilled within one generation of Jesus Christ. You know, even India with Thomas and so on. It's amazing, the world. God's not waiting for our checklist that at some magic moment every last person in the world knows. It's impossible. Like while this meeting's been on, there's been thousands of people come and go. You have to take it in a general sense. It's getting the message out and making a loud cry. But, you know, sin is a destabilizer and an unfair thing. By the false beliefs and structures and even actions of some people, there are human beings that are incapable of hearing it or understanding it if the truth is given to them. And, you know, if at the end of the day we find that in ways that we couldn't even imagine God moves supernaturally to communicate with them, fine, because God is a fair, wonderful God. But you know, I think we've got a false construct of how we get it out there. I believe to all intents and purposes, the message has been given. This is the harvest time now. This is the time of the final conflict. The battle lines have been drawn. And yes, if especially in the U.S. or in a Western country, if Adventism even though we're not the only Christians, but if Adventism were brought into a great conflict and we had Adventists on the news standing up for their faith and, you know, not moving on Sabbath even though, you know, the local law or the union or whatever is against them, that word could get out around the whole world in moments through regular media and the internet and Twitter and so on. So the potential for everybody to understand it in a moment is very high. But, you know, I just don't believe God is that shallow, that it qualifies as a chance that somebody that their whole mind structure is in opposition. You know, people's thinking is colored by their philosophical base, and someone from a Buddhist background, they don't even look at reality the same way that you do. Maybe some of you have forgotten, but you know, when you talk in school, you can discuss what is reality, what is, you know, what is the universe. Well, you know, we have a rather scientifically oriented view that's informed by our Christianity, but we see a big world. People in a little village, you know, that are thousands of years in a certain, or hundreds of years in a certain faith view, they're not educated, they're not connected to the outside world. What's it mean to them? Nothing. And you could come to them, and unless they're at a moment of crisis, because I believe crisis is where God moves in, but if they're untroubled in their belief structure, if they're uninformed about things and you present the story to them, it's probably no more to them than if Hare Krishna comes to your door and shows a fanciful picture of deities flitting in the sky. It's more than just telling. We have to do what Peter did on Pentecost, convict people, cut them to the heart. It's not just information. Anyhow, is there another?
Yeah, to what extent should we as Seventh-day Adventists participate in the political process? Should we vote?
Well, I hope you understand. I mean, I, on basic religious liberty things, I wouldn't say anything unless it's standard Adventist viewpoint. I'm not in the business with liberty of, you know, counteracting our church understanding, historic, doctrinal, and procedural views on religious liberty. On some things like this, there's differences of opinion. Ellen White, when she was speaking to students at Avondale College in Australia once, their graduation, she says that, you know, you can aspire to do anything in this world, you can sit in on political councils and so on. So in an absolute sense, it can't be totally forbidden. But I've gone out on a limb making a statement. I believe as far as major politics, certainly national politics is concerned, I don't think it's possible for elected positions for a person of moral integrity to maintain their integrity and be effective. Because the way it's run, you have to ally yourself with very undesirable factions. Like, for example, right now, with the gay lobby, you think you could get through, certainly not a Democratic one, that's for sure, you couldn't get any major Democratic position if your personal view was that this was morally wrong. And you will have to tell them otherwise. You have to misrepresent yourself regularly to one group to get their money and then say something else to another group. You have to ally with crazy groups. It's pretty much summed up with President Truman. He was put into office by the mafia chief in, what was the city he was from? Kansas City, Pendergast. And he actually said once, he says, just because I was put into office by the mafia doesn't mean that I can't be an effective politician. Well, I think it means yes, in a moral sense. I mean, he was not a bad president in many ways, but I mean, how could a Christian knowingly do that? You know, can you deal with an underworld figure to put you into place and then you act morally? I don't think so. And I remember a few years ago, I had a half-day talk to the workers in Greater New York Conference, and we got onto this. And oh man, did they get upset. We had a huge debate. And I remember even when I left, I was walking down the aisle, they were yelling out stuff after me. I came back next year, they were silent as the tomb, because I actually knew when they were arguing what was going on. At that time, the mayor of Philadelphia was John Street, a Seventh-day Adventist. And they thought this was just great. Well, a year later, his whole administration had collapsed. It was most dishonest, graft-ridden, avaricious regime that they'd seen in a long time. And you know, he'll have to deal with heaven on his status. But as a politician, he was revealed to be just another corrupt politician. Well, that's another thing. I mean, it may be a lot, but I mean, we're talking about personal integrity of an Adventist that goes there.
Well, I mean, just because in the morals and dogma, they have to cut the original morals and dogma. I mean, it states in there that
worship is... Where I think Adventists can serve, and there are a number, is some of these appointed government positions, because there you are put there by someone, and it's how you execute your office so you can maintain your integrity. But someone who's elected and the whole process of gaining money, gaining support, alliances, re-election, and so on. I just think it's drifted beyond normal Christian morality. Maybe not on a lower level, but at the very least, it's very dangerous. Very dangerous. So that's my view, but it's based on what I've seen a lot. And it's very interesting. We've had two Congress people for a while. One Democrat and one Republican, and you talk to either one, and the other is the devil incarnate. Not just politically, they malign their character to the. Maybe they're both right. I don't know. Anyhow, that's you got. Yeah.
Yeah. This morning you mentioned that Adventist probation was going to close at the Sunday law, and I agree with that. According to what I've learned in Spirit of Prophecy. But I've found that many Adventists don't understand or don't believe that. Can you, in your own opinion, can you explain why that would be dangerous?
Well, it'll be dangerous because I know the view. I've had it in my own life. The idea that you can sort of wait. Well, was it not far up the road? I forget the name of the church, but on Five a couple of months ago, we had an afternoon meeting, and a guy on the front seat, he says, "Tell us when we should be afraid." And I know what that means is, give us a heads up. When Sunday law is about to come, we'll get everything, we'll straighten out and sort of gird for the battle and make it through. And I used to have the idea that I could sort of shape up. In fact, I remember a dream when I was a teenager at the second coming, and it was all very mechanical. It was like a painted diorama type thing. And I remember the angels blowing the trumpets like sort of cutouts, and I remember thinking, I must look happy. And I think that's what's going on. No, we can't wait. Somebody said it, maybe in the Sabbath school class, a crisis doesn't develop character, it reveals it. I mean, it also develops it to a point, but if you don't have character ahead of time, so need to be prepared for it now. And yes, the Sunday law is not a test for Adventists, because we know about it, but if we're in the valley of decision when it appears, I think it's plain from what Ellen White says that it's not to get anything across to us. We're already well informed. But I don't think most Adventists know that statement. You've noticed it, right? It's very plain.
People mean that probation is going to close universally forever.
Yeah, but Ellen White does not seem to say that.
She says that.
Yeah. Right, I know that. Probation is a very interesting concept for Adventists, and it's been forgotten. My father turned me on to an Ellen White book that... I'll ask you, this is my survey. How many of you know of the book Confrontation by Ellen White? I thought we'd do one. You should read it. There's a book by Ellen White called a book, not a compilation, called Confrontation. It's a 96-page book that in her own lifetime she had printed. It was originally a series of articles, but she put it in a book, and its subtitle is The Temptations of Christ in the Wilderness. And the whole theme in that book is probation. She says that angels created in heaven were given a time of probation, and in that time of probation, a third of them fell. She says Adam and Eve were created under a time of probation, and they fell through temptation of the serpent. Jesus came to give man another time of probation. And that's not the cheap grace gospel view. And you should read that book. It's very, very good. Probation is a recurring theme in Ellen White, and of course, it's a biblical theme. It's a time, a time to establish yourself. And of course, the great part of the time of trouble is after the time of probation. And of course, Adventists are scared about the time of trouble, and I don't really know why. Because after the, I'm not happy about the whole concept. Believe me, I don't want trouble whatsoever. But as far as these cosmic events right before the return of Christ, after the close of probation and when we're sealed, there's no risk for God sealed. Angels excelling in strength will defend you. And then even before the second coming of Christ, according to Ellen White, there's a voice from heaven that announces the day and the hour. Doesn't catch Adventists by surprise, or God's redeemed, doesn't catch them by surprise. They're expecting it. It's the wicked, just like the plagues on Egypt. It's the wicked that get the brunt of all of this. Sure, it'll be tough times, but it says your food and water will be sure. Not sure for the wicked. And in Revelation twice, it says a third of mankind are going to die. Horrible things are coming, but God's people are going to be saved from it. Well, let's have one more question, because I don't know how long the meeting was run for, but I think 2 hours is enough.
I have a comment. I understand that when you accept Christ, he stands for us, and we are not condemned. He stands for our judgment. So basically, our condemnation is removed from us because we accept Christ. We're saved. And if that's the case, when do we enter into probation is closed? Is this an individual thing or a corporate thing or what? So I don't think we need to worry about when probation closes for the Adventist church or whatever, if he's judging the living now. Our names, we've been taught when we were little kids, you know, and your name comes up if you're not doing right or whatever, you're lost and all this. Well, now we're being taught that
you're
dead or not in
the temple. I think it's misleading. Because when the name comes up, it's still God knows all things. I believe that it's through to the, it's looking at your life through to the moment when he says, let he that is filthy, let him be filthy still. So everyone is at the same time, but your name may come up earlier. But no, I agree with what you say, but it's a lot of semantics can make all the difference. Our church has never bought into once saved, always saved. And Ellen White says that God looks at the trend of your life. You know, you're not lost by one little inadvertent weak act, but all conscious sin needs to be turned away from. And there is a process where we need to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, and it's all guaranteed by Christ. But read that book, Confrontation. She says there that Jesus came to give us the right for a second probation, and during this time, she says, through man in with his own power, allied to God's power, will stand in his own right as a man before God. So what she's trying to say is that it's what we do, how we act on the rights that God has given us, and the freedom and the power to live a godly life is vital. It has to be done. It's not just, God did something to reverse Adam and Eve's problem. It's for us, and we've been now placed on a similar theological basis. Adam and Eve there on their time of probation, and they fell. They could have sustained, and we are to sustain. And yet we're given more help than them. We're given the indwelling Holy Spirit. I really think people should read that book. It's a powerful little book. It starts with the story of the rebellion in heaven, and it ends. Ellen White extrapolates a bit from it, but it really ends with Christ's victory in the wilderness in defeating Satan's temptations. But she says some very interesting stuff there. This doesn't prove anything, but I should tell you because it's an interesting story. She says there after the 40 days, Christ was fainting, and Satan came to him as an angel of light, saying that he'd been sent from heaven to support Jesus. And so while he's giving him some comfort, he then tells him the story of the rebellion in heaven and how an angel had rebelled and been thrown, cast out of heaven and was in disgrace. And then he turns to Jesus, and Jesus had already told him that he was the Son of God. and he says, and here, he says, look at you. He says, you're in a pretty bad state. He says, I think you're that angel. That's an interesting statement, that he accused Jesus of being the fallen angel. You won't find that anywhere else in Ellen White's writings. And curiously, you will find that in Paradise Lost by John Milton. Where he got it from, I don't know. But there's just riches of understanding that the Bible lays out, that Ellen White extrapolates on. And Adventists, I think, need to go back to our basics in studying this stuff. And thank you for your interest in religious liberty. We've probably done a crazy sort of a spot check on stuff today, but I hope it fires up your interest to follow stuff. Don't just accept everything that happens either in the country or in the church. You know, this is God's church, I'm sure of it, not structurally. What I mean is Ellen White's was never that accepting of the organization. It was a necessary structure to carry forward the charter that people have been given by prophecy in her time. There's nothing wrong with it per se, but the structure actually will fall away at some point at the end of time. But we need to remain faithful, because God intends to have a faithful people that go through a time of trial, stand for him plainly, keep his Sabbath, keep all of his laws, love him as their only possible savior, and he will redeem us. That's the wonderful upside to it. When we look at this other, we're just describing a world that long since was fault-ridden. I mean, I get nervous about it, because even though I wasn't born in the U.S., you know, I have a high view of the United States. And so it sort of feels scary to me to describe structural decay here, but it's happening. But, you know, we shouldn't indulge that overly, but at the same time, not think it's off the table. This is a fallen world. And, you know, why should this grouping of human beings on this continent be exempt from all of the other declensions of humans around the world? Without God, human systems revert badly. And this one's lasted a few hundred years, which is bucking historic trends anyhow, other than the Roman Empire, which echoes of it still continue with Rome. Most systems come and go pretty easily. Let me just tell you one last story. I've talked about Rome and the Pope, but I saw something back around 1985 on public TV that was just amazing to me. I'd been listening to what was happening with the European Union, which I think is prophetic. I think the feet of Daniel 2 are being illustrated with the European Union. Our evangelists used to say it would never happen. They didn't have any theology for it. They just had fears of things they'd said wrong in World War I. But it's obvious that the image of Daniel 2 stands on feet. The iron of clay, a bit weak, but it stands on them. And that last system was long thought to be the remnants of the Roman Empire. And with the European Union coming together, it's the Holy Roman Empire being reestablished. And the Pope of Rome is the religious godfather of that organization. By the way, Donald Rumsfeld, during his tenure, was, you know, very fond of saying old Europe, you know, dismissing it as nothing. The facts are old Europe with the European Union is a very significant player in the world today. Its population is roughly equal to the US. Its GNP is roughly equal to the US. And Germany alone exports more goods than the United States. Just Germany. So don't wipe it off as non-event. And what's happening in Europe with Greece and Italy, their economies in trouble, is not that there's a huge problem with the whole union. It's that they have a common currency but no centralized control of nations' financial dealings. It's a structural problem that they're going to have to resolve. And in the meantime, who's bailing them out? Germany. And I've spoken to Europeans, and they see it for what I also see it as. This is the coming to power of Germany as the preeminent power in Europe. And every time that happens, there's trouble. They're a very aggressive, politically aggressive country. Back in 87, as European Union was really finding its way and formalizing, they were casting about who might be the head of state, which they've not yet chosen anyone. They have a chairman or a president, but not a head of state per se. And the Pope was one of the ones mentioned, John Paul II. He was always mentioned. And right at that time, I saw on C-SPAN a live recording, but it was, I guess it was time delayed for the US, but it had been recorded live, of the Pope addressing the European Parliament. It was very interesting. This was Pope John Paul II, and he was talking to them in German, but it was being translated, and the commentators were whispering very reverentially into their microphones as they explained it and what he was saying. And then at the key moment, it was it's a big assembly hall that's in a half circle that rises up to the back, and there's doors all along the back. And at a key moment, the doors were smashed open, and a group of about 20 or 30 demonstrators rushed in, quickly put a banner up on the back wall, and I forget what it said, and their leader, who I recognized as Ian Paisley from Northern Ireland, he went halfway down the aisle, and he went into the crouch, and he pointed to the Pope, and he yelled out, "That man is the Antichrist! That man is the Antichrist!" And, you know, that was bad manners. But it's the old view of the Protestants. But what happened next was quite amazing to me. The commentators, as the Pope stopped, and, you know, he just looked, I mean, it's not any theological reality, but just as a human being, the Pope was just ticked to the limit, angry. And the commentators said, "What an insult that this man of peace, the spiritual leader of the world, should be subjected to such a thing." And instantly, the security people grabbed a lot of them and dragged them out. Just like sacks of potatoes, instant. And the message I got from that, the Reformation is over. It's not acceptable to say the thoughts of the Reformation anymore. I mean, yes, they did an illegal act. They should have been arrested or fined or something. But I would have thought, in better times, that the commentators would at least say to repeat the theological understandings of the Reformation, not appropriate here or something like that. But no, not acceptable. This man of peace, this leader, and that's where we are now. I believe that the world is wandering after this religious political power. And in Liberty magazine, you know, we can't attack the Catholics or the Pope for being Catholic or for being Pope. They have the right. They have the right to, you know, to worship older boys if they like. Their theology doesn't matter as far as religious liberty. But what I keep saying in Liberty magazine, the fact that this church is also a state, masquerades as one or the other, it's the mortal enemy of church-state separation. It's a political power that functions as a church. And so in that regard, in some ways like Islam, because Islam will not accept separation of church and state. In that regard, we've got trouble made to order. And so with Protestant America suspending its historic and religious understandings, with Rome grasping after power in spite of the fact that they have these moral failings, something's going to happen, I believe, something interesting. You know, it's exciting to me because, you know, when you're talking about history, things that used to take hundreds of years to work out before, now they'll happen in one news cycle. In the Middle East, as I said this morning, we're seeing Christians expelled en masse from the Middle East. It's most interesting. Just yesterday on the news, I heard that most of the refugees coming out of Syria are Christians. And there was another killing of I think 100 or so Christians in that area. You need to understand the role that persecution of Christians is playing. We had a meeting, or we were called to a meeting a few months ago at the White House by Joshua Dubois. He inherited Bush's faith-based initiative. And I noticed the other day he's been replaced by Melissa Rogers. Our church had a lot of dealings with her. She used to be general counsel for the Baptists. She's written for Liberty before, but she's now the director of this department. But Joshua Dubois invited a number of people in to hear a briefing from the White House on religious freedom. And I don't always go to that, but I went, and our legislative liaison went, and I found that we were like, I don't think there were a dozen people there. We're just around a big table. and I knew most of the others around the table, and we heard this bit of briefing from these guys, and then they asked us our opinions on religious liberty. What can the White House do? And I told them something that I don't believe they took to heart, because things haven't changed. But I told them that given that Syria is ruled by the Ba'ath Party, the same political party that ruled Iraq, which we paid little attention to, the Ba'ath Party is a secular socialist party that has spent most of its energies in Iraq in particular, but also in Syria, in violently putting down religious opposition. They're in a mortal war with fundamentalist Islam for control of the state. And in the Ba'ath Party in Iraq and Syria has granted full freedom to all religious groups. So Christians have equal protection under the law in Syria and did in Iraq. So as the opposition to the Syrian Ba'ath Party and the Assad regime has begun, the first act that people have done to show that they are opposing the regime is to attack Christians and bomb Christian churches, because the Muslims see Christians as the protected favorites of this Ba'athist regime. And so I told them in this meeting, I said, whenever the president gets up and says that we hold that the Assad regime is illegitimate, needs to go, which may be true, but without any context, he might as well putting a little subtext that says to Syrians, go out and kill Christians, because that's the instant thing that will follow from that. That's the quickest, easiest way to show opposition to the regime. And that's what's happening. It just ticks up all the time. And we're looking at it from the wrong way around here. The U.S. is trying to constantly monitor whether the opposition group is full, you know, to what degree Al-Qaeda groups are taking control of the opposition. Of course they are, because from beginning to end, it's almost totally a radical Islamic reaction to a bad regime. It's true, you can't really defend the Syrians, but a regime that they object to because it has kept down fundamentalist Islam. So it's a complicated world, and a world that's just bubbling and boiling. I'll conclude with this, I promise. Many things have changed in my lifetime. You know, Australia, for example, only became independent in 1901. and I've thought back that I've lived through a quarter of the US presidents, and I don't feel that old. So I've lived long enough to see the Vietnam War was one part of this, the end of the colonial powers. I've lived long enough to see the end of communism as a global entity. I've lived long enough to see the end of global respect for capitalism. I'm saying that you can find plenty of articles that defend that, but you might not have thought about it. And I've lived to see the end of global respect for democracy. I even just read an article about it the other day that confirmed what I've thought. Self-determination is big around the world, but not democracy as we know. What we are now entering into is a period where the whole world is formulating itself by people groupings based on one of two things, usually religion, but in the absence of religion, on ethnic groupings. So that is a very dangerous dynamic, and it cannot continue for very long without religious wars. And Europe went through religious wars for, you know, the Hundred Years' War, they called it in Europe. So we likely are heading toward even more wars that, of course, the US knows are coming from resource shortages and so on. But given all of that, wars now that will be characterized by distinctly overt religious sensibilities. That's a very interesting dynamic. And so we need to watch it closely, because religious war will have great effect and ramifications for religious freedom. Thank you very much, and God bless you, and thank you for your interest. And I know you had your campaign back in January probably, but please support what we're doing with Liberty Magazine. We print nearly 200,000 Liberties every issue. Wish we could print more, but it's hit me lately that with the decline of Science and of Message magazines, that currently Liberty's circulation is equal to both of those magazines put together, which means that Liberty is our primary outreach publication, and not to the same group of people, since it's going to lawyers, judges, mayors, state and federal politicians, and so on, these thought leaders. These are not, this is not a category of people that we would typically be contacting anyway, and Ellen White was most specific that we need to contact these people. And we can with Liberty Magazine. We get very good comments back from them regularly. They don't all agree with it, but it's not so much that they all have to agree, but we want them to be informed. We want them to know what we believe. And very, very often we get very positive comments back from these people that they use it, they refer to it. We've had law professors that even use it in their class, not as their textbook, but as examples. And it's only possible with your money. There's no other source of money for what we do than the annual appeal. You know, it's not for my salary, that's paid, but the production and distribution of the magazine is 100% dependent on January through end of April appeal throughout the division. So thank you in advance, and please support religious liberty, because to support that is to support what we stand for as a church.